Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is season 2 of Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Kurt Anderson is here, one of my favorites, super excited that he consented and agreed to come on the show. We had a great talk, excited to share that with you in a minute. We've got a great season so far. I spent the last two weeks doing some interviews, and we've got some really good shows. I'm so excited for them. It's been a nutty 2 weeks. What can I say? I was off, but I wasn't really off. I just wasn't producing content. In the parlance of our times, content. I hate that word, content. I'm going to create content. It just sounds so dreary, right? But I guess that is what I'm doing here, creating content. So I wasn't doing that, but I was still around. I was still paying attention. And in the last 2 weeks, what appears to have happened is that America has lost its fucking mind. I mean, so many weird. So it's appropriate that Kurt is here because he wrote Fantasyland, which is about how America and Americans believe and have a tropism to believe things that are just batshit insane. I'm simplifying. It's a wonderful book that everybody should read. It's really just kind of a mind blow book. We have a situation now where in this 2 week period, Trump was booed at his own rally for saying that people should get vaccinated. I mean, I don't know how much crazier it can get than that. You finally have this asshole coming clean, probably because his lawyers told him to, and nobody believes him anyway. It's like it's too late. He's already radicalized these people to such a degree that they no longer believe the truth when they hear it. And, you know, Mo Brooks was booed in Mississippi. Which is, I'm fascinated by Mississippi, and we're going to talk about that later this season on the podcast. Also, the Mississippi Free Press, which does great work down there, there was an article where the quotes here are just insane. The health officer, the state health officer of the state of Mississippi, actually had to have a press conference and say, you know, please work with your doctor. This is medical treatment. You wouldn't get your chemotherapy at the feed store. I mean, you wouldn't want to treat your pneumonia with your animal's medication. It can be dangerous to get the wrong doses of medication, especially for something that's meant for a horse or a cow. Now, I don't want to like pile on. It's easy for me here in my suburban and previously my urban life to sort of laugh at people who would do something like that. But it just speaks to the insanity, you know, that's going on. And it's not just in Mississippi. It's everywhere. It's in New York City, for God's sake. Jordan Clapper did this thing. We mentioned him in the podcast. Kurt mentions him. Where he interviewed people at an anti-vax rally in New York City. And they just, there's madness there. And, you know, everybody seems to have gone insane. I mean, if you pull back and look at it from space, right, you come to, just with the vaccine thing, here is a thing that will save you from dying. Why would you not take this thing? All the scientists, the doctors who do the studies, you know, everybody that you know in your world who's pretty smart has done this. So why are you listening to, like, the MyPillow guy type people? Why are you listening to people on Fox News who, by the way, have all been vaccinated and are lying to you about the vaccine? I don't understand. And this isn't even hard to figure out. Pictures on the internet of Rupert Murdoch getting the vaccine. And yet Fox News continues to drive this and fuel the fire of our collective mass ignorance. It's really mind-boggling. I just don't understand it. And I do understand it because I read Fantasyland, and Kurt explained it really nicely why it is baked into our culture to believe crazy nonsense. Yeah, so that happened. I think everyone's gone crazy. Even my own little orbit, people seem to be going crazy, because what's happening is it's late August, school is starting. The kids have basically been home from school for, you know, effectively 2 years almost, a year and a half, whatever it is. And everybody's anxious about it, man, because they haven't been in school. High school is stressful anyway. You throw on to it the fact that, okay, we haven't done this in a really long time. The muscle memory is a little bit atrophied. And then are we wearing masks? Are we going to get sick? What's the deal with the teacher? Like, the whole thing is extremely, extremely stressful. And I feel like people are losing their fucking minds. So, you know, that's the thing about the schools. Everybody is, we have to be safe. We have to be safe. But at a certain point also, especially in high schools when everybody is vaccinated or should be vaccinated, mental health really comes into the picture. You know, it's not healthy mentally for kids to be home for another 6 months and lose another year to this. It just isn't. So then it becomes a sort of grim calculus of what do you prioritize? Oh man. Like I said, everything's going crazy. The Afghanistan stuff is crazy. You'd think that it was just this, I don't even know, to watch CNN and listen to the CNN reporting and the media reporting. You'd think it was this, basically another terrorist attack or something. And in fact, that's not what's happening at all. You know, they got, 70,000 people out of Afghanistan. Maybe by now it's more. How many, what are they supposed to do? I mean, I feel like CNN failed much worse than Joe Biden failed in this Afghanistan thing. So we could argue about the politics of it, whether it was the wise move to leave or not leave. Should we have left 3,000 troops there and tried to prop up this government that the people there clearly can't, you know, keep unless we're there? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. But in terms of what Biden was obligated to do, you know, he's done it pretty admirably as far as I'm concerned. So it's certainly not worthy of all of the chaotic headlines and the mass craziness emanating from the CNN. But you could tell that these news groups miss the chaos of Trump, right? They want Biden to fuck up so bad. And, you know, that we kind of go into this too in the podcast here with Kurt, because we at the end, we talk a little bit about the media, that the media has become, I think, the media members themselves on these shows and everything else, they've become addicted to the high that comes with being, you know, on everybody's minds all the time. Because for 4 years of Trump, we treated the news differently than we normally would. We hung on to every word. And these guys and gals became, you know, celebrities. And that gets addictive. And now, in the age of Biden, who is sensible and prudent and good, there's not as much outrage. There's not as many clicks. Some people have tuned it out. And I think that these guys are in some sort of withdrawal. I really do. You know, just like the addiction model, as Kurt says, is something that the social media companies take advantage of. I think within the media, it's become a thing where they're, you know, they're addicted, man. They're addicted to the attention, and they're not getting it right now like they used to. They're just not. And any time Biden does anything that even hints at being controversial or a screw-up, man, they swoop on him like vultures. It's really disgraceful. But, you know, that's the culture that we live in, and that's what I mean. America has lost its fucking mind in these 2 weeks. Lost its mind. So, anywho, I've already talked too long here. I want to say a quick thank you to everybody who subscribed to the Prevail Substack, which I do. That's back on now. I'm doing it 3 times a week, Tuesday and Friday, and then also the Sunday Pages literary piece on Sunday. That's going to resume this Sunday. And I wasn't sure what to expect. I made these indexes, which were kind of like greatest hits collections of stuff that I'd written. And, you know, lo and behold, everybody read them a lot and signed up and subscribed. So I'm really grateful for that. Thank you so much. We are in season 2 here. If you'd like to advertise on this show, you know, check us out on the MSW Network. Go to the webpage and click around and you'll see how you might do that, you know? And again, I never know if I should tease the future episodes and let people know who's going to be on or not, or if I should just let it play out. I will say this. I feel like I'm going to keep it a little bit close to the vest. There will be a 9/11 special that I recorded yesterday with a surprise guest, and it's really great. I'm really excited for that. That's coming on the 10th of September, which is a Friday, a day before the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which I was in New York City for. And the episode is not going to be about the politics or the anything. It's just going to be about the day itself and what happened on that day, because I feel like in the intervening 20 years, maybe some of the memories have been lost, and I want to make sure that they're retained, and I want to share my story with you guys. So that's coming up. That's really exciting for me, and it's a great episode. So I've got a bunch of great people on deck in episodes to come, but right now, the author of Fantasyland and Evil Geniuses, one of the co-founders of my favorite spy magazine, Kurt Anderson. We'll be right back with Kurt right after this.
Hello, Amerikanci. My name is Dmitry Medvedev, Prime Minister of Russian Federation country. After a long day of performing primary function of being shorter than President Putin, this is my favorite way for me to end every day. Me, my stuffed bear Mishka, and a hot cup of plutonia seasoning sleepy time tea. It's like symphonia of natural Russian aromas, tree bark, beetroot extract, antifreeze, and Novichok. Just kidding. Novichok have no taste and smell. Everyone knows that. And because plutonia seasonings puts more trava, how you say herbs, in steebeck, you get more atravlenia, you know, taste, and more polonium. Plutonia seasoning sleepy time tea might be best cup of tea you ever drink. Definitely will be the last. Plutonia seasonings, taste from nature, aftertaste from Putin.
Plutonia seasonings, available at Walmart, Amazon, and Home Goods in the pest control section.
На здоровье! You take first step. I insist!
Kurt Anderson, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Very happy to be here, Greg.
This is going to be the first episode of season 2, which is really dumb because there's no story arc or anything. I just was like, I needed 2 weeks off, so we're going to end season 1 and have season 2. So you're the big guest for the beginning.
Happy to be on your premiere when, you know, the new character.
Yeah, you're the new character. So, okay, just to get people acquainted with who you are. Okay, so you've written for The New Yorker, for New York, for Time. You hosted Studio 360 and you won a Peabody Award for that. You got to go into all this cool arts and culture stuff. You have 3 novels out, which were all, you know, sold well. They all got good reviews. You were at the Harvard Lampoon back when it was really meaningful and funny. And you've co-founded freaking Spy Magazine, which to me, you know, this is sort of the ne plus ultra of satirical New York cool. Although, you know, I read it in high school. I was in New Jersey and I didn't quite understand all the references.
No, but people exactly your age were the perfect generation and are still the people, many of them, as well as older people, who come up to me and treat me with more respect than I deserve because they were adolescents and people in their early 20s, you know? I was only in my early 30s, but, you know, still.
I still don't know who Georgette Mosbacher is, but I feel like I should have known, and that made it cool. And if that wasn't enough, okay, you've done all this cool shit. Now you write these two books. You write Fantasyland and Evil Geniuses, which we're going to talk about. And they're both so good. They're so funny, but also sharp and incisive and all this kind of stuff. So basically, for me, for a guy like me, you have the best possible resume. Have you won a MacArthur Award yet?
No, but I have accurately predicted other people winning them. I've met people and interviewed them on Studio 360 and said, you're going to win a MacArthur in the next couple of years. And it happened. So, but no.
That's the only way I can get cooler. Every year that comes and goes, I make a joke. I'm like, well, maybe next year for me. it's never gonna happen. Okay, so just I want to talk about Spy, and I want to talk about the two books. So it's okay. This weird interview where we're gonna be, you know, early and late. Okay, so talk about the idea of that magazine, because was it you coming out of college when you did that, or did you have a little bit of experience? And what was were you trying to just write humor? Or did you have a vision that was, you know, became what it was?
It launched 10 years after I got out of college. One of my co-founders, along with my wife, along with my friend Tom Phillips, was Graydon Carter, who was is 5 years older than I, and had started a little magazine in Canada where he grew up. And so, you know, had that. Unlike me, who I'd never been an editor of anything, I'd been a writer on magazines and TV and stuff. And so we really began talking about it, Graydon and I, for a couple of years before we started it, and really not even like, oh, let's start a business. It was more like as we were becoming friends, we would have lunch and say, what were our favorite magazines? Oh, Esquire back then. Or, oh, National Lampoon at a certain point. Oh. And then we began thinking, why don't we have a favorite magazine now that we would every month, let's say, when it comes to the door, we're excited and we pour through it. And what would that be? And so it really began as a kind of just really a conversational lark that continued. And so we did develop a vision of what it would be. And it would be, and it was, and it would be this humorous, satirical sensibility, you know, affected by having read Mad Magazine when we were kids and National Lampoon when we were teenagers and so forth, and by the David Letterman show sensibility, which was new at that time, but welded to journalism, welded to facts, welded to research. And so that's what we did differently than really had been done in any significant way in the United States. Private Eye in the UK had kind of sort of done that, and they were definitely a model of a kind. But so, yeah, we had this model and we were very lucky with our timing, right? It was before the internet.
Yes.
And just before the internet. And it was right 3 or 4 years into this incredible bull market that made a lot of people rich, some of whom we knew and were willing to give us money to start this crazy little independent magazine. So that's how it happened.
It was also good timing for me because I think it started in 86. I went to high school in 87 and then graduated in 91. So it was right in my wheelhouse to try to figure out what all was going on. So I know you told the story before because it seems like all of the genius of Spy is crystallized into several anecdotes, which is weird, and I want to talk about that too. But can you tell for the listeners the story about the spy prank where you wrote the checks to the famous people?
Yeah, we did pranks, right? And because we were monthly, I mean, the monthliness, which again is really barely exists anymore as a frequency, was really useful because we could really plot and plan and burnish things rather than just throw them out there 10 times an hour, you know, yeah. As you kids do today. So we did various pranks, meaningful pranks, not just like, oh, let's make fun of this person, but like, let's get the White House Chief of Staff, John Sununu, on the phone and over time and say, we have this job for you and get him to embarrass himself. Anyway, this one of the great ones we did, which was a really long con, was we set up this thing called the National Refund Clearinghouse, and sent checks for a dollar and change to about 60 really rich New Yorkers, because we were at the beginning very focused on New York. And they weren't all New Yorkers, but mostly, but well-known multimillionaires, because there were no billionaires then, virtually. Said, "Oh, and we're sorry. We owe you this money." And we were vague about what it was for. We just said, "Here's this check for $1.38 or 64 or whatever it was." And we wanted to see who would cash these tiny checks among these very, very rich people. And about half of them, I think, cashed that first one and deposited it. And then we, after a little while, we sent another check from the National Refund Clearinghouse saying, "Oh, we're very sorry again. We still owe you another 57 cents. And sent them a check for 57 cents. And if less than half of them deposited that. We kept going. And we got down, I believe, to 13 cents. And finally, only two of the original 60 rich people cashed them. One was Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi arms dealer, famous and rich at the time, now dead, and before he died, not rich, and Donald Trump, who was just on the verge of his first bankruptcy at the time, which we didn't even know when we finished the prank, and there he was. And so, yeah, it was really fun, and just having all these canceled checks by all these rich people for tiny amounts was fun.
What do you still have them? What happened to them?
Somebody has them. Some archivist has them somewhere.
So, you know what? And I have a couple of the issues of spy on my desk. What's astonishing about them, looking back, is how relevant all of this stuff still is in many cases. Like the humor and the journalism both. Like this. Here's an episode. This issue has an article called "Was Donald Trump Ever Rich?" And it has a picture of him wearing a barrel, which great. Then there's another one that has a big article about Robert Maxwell going through, at the time, the big pension thing. And then I think this was probably a couple months before he died unceremoniously. And this is shit I'm still writing about 30 years later. It's really kind of nuts.
Well, and yes, Donald Trump was one of our recurring, became frankly our main recurring character. And this was, you know, we started in 86. He wasn't yet famous. He hadn't even published his big bestseller, The Art of the Deal, yet. So we and he rode an escalator up together, I guess you could say. And when I look back, you know, and then, you know, I basically, you know, so I left Spy in 1993 and kind of stopped thinking about Donald Trump, you know, never watched The Apprentice and wrote about him a couple of times, just like, oh yeah. But until he became president, of course, I didn't really think about him or the spy coverage. And I went back and looked at that very coverage you're talking about. And it was kind of amazing. From our first issue, was called "Jerks, the 10 Most Embarrassing New Yorkers." Donald Trump, one of them, in which he was saying, "I could be president. I could negotiate an arms missile deal with the Soviet Union in an hour. I know everything there is to need." So the guy was that, you know, 35 years ago. And then I came across this piece I'd completely forgotten about this firm that Paul Manafort and Roger Stone had, called Manafort and Stone, who were representing all the worst, horrible dictators around the world. And as you say, I mean, you know, not to pat myself on the back.
Toot the horn. It's supposed to be tooted.
But we did. I mean, it shows not that we're so brilliant, but it shows that if you try to tell the truth at any given moment, it's going to age well, you know?
Yeah. Well put. Truth, we're going to get to that in a minute, because that's a big theme of yours. So is there any, I should also mention that, you know, Spy is also famous because Graydon Carter, who you mentioned, called Trump famously a short-fingered Bulgarian, which is such a, no?
Well, the magazine coined that term, and we all called, and the magazine called him that.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And I think Graydon would certainly agree that it was a collective
coinage. Okay, no, I want to give credit properly.
No, Graydon certainly was the person, while we were starting Spy, before we started, who did a profile of Donald Trump and came back to me and our little office and said, "This guy, Donald Trump, he has the shortest fingers I've ever seen." So certainly the empirical observation that led to that coinage was his.
I think it's interesting that it's been now misquoted. People say, "Oh, small hands, but
stubby fingered." Yeah, right.
Yeah, short fingered is so, it's chef's kiss. It's so
thank
good.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, okay. So is there any part of 1986, 1987 you okay, that would ever think that 30 whatever years later, that this, of all the people you wrote about, that, okay, in 2021, Donald Trump, of all the people, would be the guy, not only the president, but the guy trying to overthrow the government, whereas Eddie Murphy is just casually launching Coming to America 2 in semi-obscurity. Like, I mean, you know, do you have days when you think this is all like a glitch in the simulation?
Yes. I remember the moment when it was, I don't know if I literally did a spit take when it happened as I was watching the debate in 2015 or 2016 where Marco Rubio and Donald Trump were talking about the size of his fingers. But it was like, I mean, I don't really believe in acid flashbacks, but it was the closest thing to one I've ever had, you know, in that exactly that sense. Like, here are these candidates for president, one of whom would become president, arguing about whether our little stupid puerile epithet from 1988 was accurate on a debate stage for the presidency. I mean, it was nuts. And yeah, the whole, no, I, of course not. And it was, it would be a thing we would talk. I mean, we did actually one future, here's Trump in the future, and we showed him being fat, so that was right. But what has happened is so over the top, so beyond plausibility for even the most over the top satirical fiction. No.
I remember Bloom County, which was also around the same time. He did a thing where in the future, and he said something about I can't remember the setup, but the punchline was, we were going to do that, but then, you know, with the air traffic controllers, but then President Springsteen fired everybody. And, you know,
that's funny.
I wish that had become the reality. And not
that would have
been a much better.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, again, and as somebody who's written, you know, quasi satirical fiction over the years, in my first novel was that, you know, it was my taste for satirical long form prose fiction novels is far too restrained to meet the reality that has occurred, you know.
It's busted through the yeah. thing. So now, and this is a good segue into you know, the blur, or really the destruction of the line between fact and fiction, is a segue to Fantasyland, which is your great book. The subtitle is How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. So this book to me, I mean, it was such a mind blow, because I love books like this anyway, where you're taking this sweeping, and I know you know what the book is about. I'm saying this for people who might not have read it. You know, this sweeping survey of a large historical period, but you're looking at it through a very specific lens. I love books like that anyway, because it helps you kind of refresh what you know and remember all this kind of stuff. And this one is, you know, it's funny, but it's also smart and convincing. And your thesis is basically, as I badly state it, is that Americans, you know, white European Americans came to this country originally because basically they were more gullible than everybody else and more willing to believe the hype. And that gullibility is as much a part of the national fabric as individualism, Protestant work ethic, and indifference to the rest of the world. So I want to read just quickly one paragraph from the introduction to your book, and then I'll ask you to explain it better than I did. Okay, this is from Fantasyland. America was created by true believers and passionate dreamers, by hucksters and their suckers, which over the course of four centuries has made us susceptible to fantasy, as epitomized by everything from Salem hunting witches to Joseph Smith creating Mormonism, from P.T. Barnum to Henry David Thoreau to speaking in tongues, from Hollywood to Scientology to conspiracy theories, from Walt Disney to Billy Graham to Ronald Reagan to Oprah Winfrey to Donald Trump. In other words, mix epic individualism with extreme religion, mix show business with everything else, let all that steep and simmer for a few centuries, run it through the anything goes 1960s and the internet age. The result is the America we inhabit today, where reality and fantasy are weirdly and dangerously blurred and commingled. So that's, yeah, so good.
Thank you. And I want to note that you know, I finished writing this book in the spring of 2016, right before Donald Trump was even nominated, and had started writing it, thinking about it for a long time, but started writing in 2014. Only because many people, even who've read this book, think like, oh, great, Donald Trump became president and you wrote this book to sort of reverse engineer how it happened. And no, quite the opposite. I had this thought, an idea, did this deep long history, and Donald Trump showed up at the last minute to be the poster boy, you know? So I just want to make that clear. And the other thing to say in a kind of pre-butthole way, I think, is that there is, as we all know, and we're told again and again and again, and it's true, a good side to that, which is like, oh, we had big imaginations, dream the impossible dream, make wonderful things happen, invent computers, blah, 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 blah. All true. But let's look at the flip side, the dark side, the downside, which has become an existential crisis over the last half century. And that's what this book's about.
Well, one of the things about America, too, is that we don't look at the dark side.
Well,
the side.
Yes, we don't.
We're not allowed to go back and admit defeat or that we made mistakes or anything like that. Ever.
Yes, but I am introducing critical fantasy theory of America that has not yet been made illegal in America. So.
So what was the impetus for the book? Because you said, you know, it came out, and I have this written down. It came out in 2017, which means it was written before that. So what you said just now, you were obviously it had been germinating in your mind for a while. What was there one key event that was the impetus
Not so much a key event. It was a slow boil. I sometimes have epiphanies, but usually it's a slow boil. And it was, again, I had gotten old enough, frankly, that I saw the change in just, for instance, not exclusively, but for instance, the craziness and prominence of Christian Protestant fundamentalism. You know, I grew up in Nebraska, right? So it wasn't like I was some liberal coastal bubble living libtard. I was a libtard, but a self unradicalized libtard in Omaha, Nebraska. Anyway, I'd seen this happen and getting worse and worse, and getting this you know, fantasies and fictions of various kinds becoming more and more legitimized, and certainly making their way more and more into the Republican mainstream. My parents had been Republicans, like, you know, the almost non-existent, old-fashioned, legit, like, you know, arts-loving, atheistic Republicans.
Right.
Imagine. So I'd seen this happening, and then I, as I talk about right at the beginning of the book, I remember thinking on the first episode of the Stephen Colbert's Colbert Report, when he did his famous essay, bit, whatever, monologue about truthiness, thinking, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, a few years later, it had germinated into what I thought was a book. And so, you know, it was a lot of things. There was no like, oh my God, look at what we've become. It was a, you know, decade long, oh my God, look what we're becoming.
Was there some point, you know, just from a writerly standpoint, because you have this thesis going in, was there some point going through the history when you thought, oh yeah, this thesis definitely holds?
Like, well, I didn't know, actually, because I was not raised religiously, even though in our Unitarian church that I attended a few times, we were taught about all religions. But I didn't know that much about the history of American Protestantism and Christianity. So, and I had been interested almost separately from this for a long time of like, why is America so religious? Exactly what makes that happen? Why is that? And I read a lot, and I was sort of dissatisfied with all the scholarly answers to that question. So I just started reading about that, and I felt like had not one giant aha moment, but like a lot of moments as I really came to understand Protestantism and early Protestantism and separated from the Pilgrims, you know, as what I'd learned in grade school, right? But then once, you know, when you start anything, I mean, you've written books, you know, you have this note, this note, this note, maybe. But as you're implying, as you're suggesting, then you began looking at entertainment, for instance. I didn't start with the idea that the way that everything in America, practically everything, evolves inevitably into entertainment was a major part of my theory of the case. But then, as I look back and read about P.T. Barnum and Buffalo Bill and all the rest, it's like, wow, this puzzle I'm creating, I'm not just crazily putting pieces together. It really is a picture that I am finding puzzle pieces that fit into. So again, I don't remember if there was, aha, I have it, a moment of craziness where I'd connected enough strings and scotch tape and thumbtacks on the wall. But I certainly I did feel there was, as you're suggesting, a moment where I thought like, wow, this is like a, this is like a big theory of the case that I haven't seen done. And so, yeah, I was happy that I had, you know, when you write a book often, I often, any book I've written, I often get in the middle and feel, what am I doing? What is this? I can't go back. I'm too far out in the lake or whatever to, I got to keep swimming. So there was this moment where it was like, well, no, this is real. This is real. Keep swimming, you know, and I you know, and as I say, then I literally remember like early in 2016 when Donald Trump started winning, you know, primaries. One morning I said to my wife as we were reading the newspaper, like, well, I know this is crazy and he probably won't win the nomination and it's bad for America, but man, this is going to be good for this book. So that was the closest thing to a memorable aha moment I had about that.
Oh my God. You less moonvez
well,
yourself.
A little bit. I have only half jokingly called myself ever since this book came out, a Trump profiteer, but you know, yeah.
Well, you know, you and me both. I'm no, you know, I could.
Exactly.
I had 800 Twitter followers and now I have many, many more.
Well, exactly.
That.
Well, and people, when Trump became president, people, some in earnest, began accusing me and us and Spy Magazine of having created him. And I said, come on. And no. And if you're going to go there, we tried to kill baby Hitler, right? We were there trying to kill baby Hitler, but we failed.
So as we said, the book comes out in 2017, right? So it's the early on in Trump's presidency. The presidency, the first White House press conference with the first White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, is him insisting indignantly that we believe something that is demonstrably untrue. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that the last, 5 years have become, we've veered further into fantasy land than, you know, more back. So, I mean, is there anything... Any obviously Trump writ large, but is there any single things in the last 4 years that you think, God, if this book has another edition, maybe I'll go in and include this? Or,
well, that's an interesting question. You know, QAnon appeared like essentially the day after the book came out. I mean, you know, so that's the one thing that if I were of a mind to spend time writing an extra chapter, it would be kind of, you know, QAnon and QAnonism. And, you know, and yes, as you say, everything that's happened in the last 4 years. But QAnon in particular, and I remember there was Jordan Klepper, you know, the comedian and guy from The Daily Show and everything, had a show on back then in which he posed as a kind of conspiracy theory nut. It was on Comedy Central, not very long. It was a good show. And he had me on right after QAnon started with this great piece about QAnon in which I was, you know, appeared as the expert. And I remember thinking at the time, like, well, I figured at the time, I think this is just another little cult and we won't even think of it. You know, it will have its moment and 6 months from now, a year from now, we probably won't even know it. And of course, I was under... believing in my own theory of the case that we were a nation of a certain kind of craziness in which the internet made all things possible, all these bad things possible. So no, beyond it, no one thing. I thought about adding a, you know, writing more and saying, oh, look, but A, it would be like, oh, look how right I was 4 years ago. I'm like, eh. And I feel like I make the case in this very long book enough that readers can connect the dots to post 2017 events by themselves and have fun doing so. Play at home.
I think it's like you're you know, you're coming along saying, you know, at some point basketball players might be able to go above the rim, and then Michael Jordan comes along and dunks
yeah,
in the free
yeah,
throw.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
no,
yeah, my work here is done, you know.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Well, and then what did happen actually, as you know, because I this other history book that I wrote came out of Fantasyland because I thought, okay, here's this stew of craziness that lost its tempering systems, right? All this nuttiness that we've always had it was okay until it wasn't in the last few decades. But that's not the whole story, I realized, as I was writing and finishing and then actually talking about with readers in the world Fantasyland. I realized, well, it's not all that. It's not just, oh, Americans are stupid and crazy. Yes, they are. But how were they exploited by whom for what purpose became the other half of the story that I hadn't told. I remember specifically, actually, in an early book event for Fantasyland, some questioner woman said, but, okay, you talk about, like, climate change and that you talk about why Americans are willing to embrace the lies that climate change isn't real, global warming isn't real. But isn't that just about the Koch brothers? And I said, and my off-the-cuff answer was, well, it isn't just about the Koch brothers. It's about the all these soft-minded, politicized people on the right being willing to believe this manifest set of falsehoods. But then I realized, no, that is the other half of it, right? And and I realized that, you know, even if there were as many people predisposed to believe exciting falsehoods as Americans are in Denmark or Canada or Japan or whatever, even if they had their own Koch brothers feeding them the misinformation about global warming, they wouldn't have gone there as much. So I realized, oh, it is a synergistic thing, and that there was some sequelish history to write about how this wasn't just organic. That there was a whole other set of things that created inequality and insecurity and economic immobility and on and on and on. So I wrote this book about that economic part of the, as a friend of mine said, the fuckening of America. He says, you've written two books in what I hope is a trilogy of the fuckening of America. And so that's what Evil Geniuses became.
Okay, we're going to be right back because I want to talk about Evil Geniuses at length. So we'll be right back with Kurt Anderson.
I'm former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figluzzi. Join me on a journey deep inside the world's premier law enforcement agency to decode the mysteries and challenges of today's FBI. The threats facing America are as real as the men and women who battle to protect us. In this first-of-a-kind podcast, we'll sit down with active-duty FBI personnel who reveal their mission, their cases, and their lives. Let's go inside the Bureau with Frank Figluzzi.
Homicides, sexual assaults, missing persons, and unidentified human remains.
Somehow a computer could solve crimes.
93 homicides.
I am one of those guys that I've wanted to be an FBI in since I was 6 years old.
M.O., his modus operandi.
Busting down doors with guns drawn.
But I would be lying to you if I said I wasn't much more aware of the guy sitting in a vehicle on the roadside when I'm walking my dog at night.
Unsolved cases sitting in evidence rooms on shelves.
They didn't want to have sex with them. They just wanted to kill someone.
Okay, we're back with Kurt Anderson. So you set the book up well yourself, and I think you're right that Evil Geniuses, the full title, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History, is a companion piece to Fantasyland in many ways, because it really delves into almost the Oz behind the curtain and what and who's directing these people. And in the book, you know, you trace how there's a small but powerful cabal of basically free market. I wrote down libertarian assholes, but I think that's a superfluous, right?
Yeah. No, that was the title I rejected. No,
you know, they reversed all of the gains from the middle class, from FDR, from LBJ, and brainwashed people into believing Ronald Reagan completely. I many times on the podcast when I go on the air, I rail against this Reagan, you know, government is the problem thing, which might be the single most destructive thing any president has ever said ever. I mean, I don't know. It's just so bad.
Yeah.
And you had a nice phrase in the book. You say they turned the New Deal into the raw deal. I guess you already answered. This came about in discussions from Fantasyland, right?
Yeah.
The idea of this book.
Yeah. And you know, the It was also, as you know, because you've read the book, it was part of my own coming to grips with my own, not total self-delusion. I didn't have a 180-degree apostasy. However, I mean, the cultural thing, as is probably implicit or clear from the Spy Magazine conversation we've had, was my focus in my thinking and writing and media making. So Fantasyland naturally came out of that. Oh, look at these loons, you know. Whereas the kind of economic thing was just like, yeah, sure, I read the stories. I knew it was happening. I voted the right way, you know. But I didn't, even though that had been my college major, economics and sociology and stuff, I hadn't looked at it as closely, partly because I was doing fine. I wasn't getting fucked by this shift in the paradigm, by the you know, a lowering of the minimum wage and on and on and on and on. So I didn't look as closely as I should have what was happening in the 80s and 90s, really until the aughts when I started like paying attention a generation afterwards. So you know, economics, I mean, yes, I had taken economics courses in college, but I needed to learn the entire history of American Christianity to write Fantasyland, I had to learn more about economics and the legal profession and all this other stuff that were all pieces of this amazing, brilliant, evil genius campaign.
You know, one of the things, and you allude to it, one of the things that's so great about the book is that you interject yourself in it so often, because I feel like it, you know, it's just the right amount of you saying, hey, I, you know, you wave at the reader kind of just at the right moments, saying, okay, well, you know, I kind of know Warren Buffett a little bit, and that's a bad example, but, you know.
Yeah, mostly it's not name dropping. Mostly it's saying I'm an asshole. Yeah,
It's self-reflective. You're looking, going back and looking at how you thought and saying, how could I have done better? What could I have done? And I think that's great. And I think, you know, probably if more Americans did that, we would be happier and better off as a society, certainly. There's so many good observations in there about, you know, how the political system works. One of them is, it just occurred to me now, is how you sort of compare Nixon and Clinton, the way that, you know, that both of them had to, you know, Nixon is a Republican and he's perceived as this, because, but actually, if you go back and look at what he did pre-Watergate, a lot of it was pretty, you know, liberal kind of stuff that liberals would like. I mean, creating the EPA and most of a lot of the justices that he put on the Supreme Court wound up being on our side and stuff like that.
And you go on and on. I mean, I don't want to write that book, but you, liberal Richard Nixon, the most liberal president between LBJ and Joe Biden, is true.
Yeah, no, it is. And then, you know, Clinton, on the other hand, is the, you know, Democrat who comes in and is the opposite. He, you know, kind of takes, you know, he's catering to the I guess, almost the mores of the time. So, and does things that are more quote unquote old school Republican, and you know, and they mirror each other. I think also both of them very smart people as personalities.
For sure. Well, and the thing about Clinton, I mean, Clinton properly, you know, and Clintonism and the Clinton administration gets, okay, that's when Democrats really gave up any real claim to being the Labor Party or the party of the left economically and so forth. But it had started, and I was reminded as I did the research that Gary Hart, you know, coming off managing George liberal, you know, crazy liberal George McGovern's campaign, ran for the Senate as an anti-New Deal Democrat, as this new kind of groovy anti-New Deal Democrat. And so it was really, you know, and then Jimmy Carter, too. I mean, bless his heart, was you know, a very moderate, was domestically far more conservative than Richard Nixon, who had just preceded him, right? Yeah. So that shift, that paradigm shift, yes, which the right very brilliantly exploited, was happening organically very quickly between Richard Nixon leaving office in 1974 and Jimmy Carter being elected president 2 years later, right? So it was already happening, and they just saw it, took it, and ran with it.
Yeah. And you go in the book, you really break down well all of the stuff happening in the country and analyzing why this happened and how they were able to exploit it. So, OK, so one of your theories in Evil Geniuses is that the 1980s never ended. It feels like this is a fun point for you, which I guess explains why the old episodes of Spy are so relevant. You mentioned earlier John Sununu, who plays a key role here in Evil Geniuses, alas, right? So I told this to my wife, and she was like, no, it's not the 80s. It's the 90s that never ended. The fashion is the same. This, that, or the other is the same. It's the night. She was very indignant about this. And I think it changed in 1991 specifically. It's fall of the Soviet Union. The reality TV is starting to come into the fore. And the web browser is introduced, and it's
totally,
the first big recession.
Totally. Yeah.
And I graduated from high school, so that's
there you go. Which is a key milestone in this transformation. Yeah. I don't disagree with your wife that it was the 90s where finally nothing ever changed, right? I mean, yes, 80s stuff still, you know, except at the sort of fashion forward part of the 80s, which was already looking 90s. It looks a little different, but the 90s, the kind of early, exactly. I mean, you know, Liz Phair becomes a star, the internet starts. I mean, I could, a lot of
go
things
for,
happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's when everything had changed, and then everything else culturally and otherwise stopped changing.
I mean, it's fast because you talk a lot about nostalgia and retro in the book, which I think is, you know, it's fascinating. Like there were times when America is very forward-looking, and then starting in the 70s, especially this real push towards nostalgia, even recent nostalgia. And it reminded me of that story in The Onion, okay, which I'm sure you know. This is published in 1997. I'm going to quote now. At a press conference Monday, U.S. Retro Secretary Anson Williams issued a strongly worded warning of an imminent national retro crisis, cautioning that if current levels of U.S. retro consumption are allowed to continue unchecked, we may run entirely out of past by as soon as 2005. We are talking about a potentially devastating crisis situation in which our society will express nostalgia for events which have yet to occur.
Wow, I don't know that. That's wonderful.
That? Oh my God, I can't believe
that. That is so fantastic.
Google it. It's so good.
I will. No, I mean, and again, I mean, all of my stuff intermingles with all my other stuff. I mean, in Evil Geniuses, I quote this piece that Paul Rudnick and I wrote in Spy in 1989 about the irony epidemic, as we call it. And a big part of that was exactly that, was the takeover of retroism as a kind of MO in America.
Now, and you can see it in the pop culture, especially with movies and TV shows. Like I think you mentioned it in the book. It never did remakes or reboots of things. It's all the time. It's got to be some platform. It's got to be another goddamn comic book from 1972 or whatever. So I know it's only been a year now since the book has come out. Do you see any hope for us getting out of this nostalgia loop?
Well, maybe. I mean, I see more. That's a good question. Have there been, I harp on it. When I see something that seems truly new, I always love it. I haven't seen it in a big way, and maybe it's just because I don't have enough distance, or we don't have enough distance yet. I mean, so I don't necessarily see an escape from it, but if nothing else, I feel like maybe, there was WandaVision, for instance. I liked WandaVision as a show,
yeah,
but
great.
Like, you know, and of course I liked WandaVision because it alluded to my own TV youth,
yep.
You know, but so I haven't yet seen the wow, nothing like that has ever been done before that makes me, or and that, it makes me think like, oh, we are on the verge of some, you know, Renaissance or breaking out of the nostalgia loop. Now, I have been, you know, as many of us have been, somewhat hopeful about the bigger issues of Evil Geniuses, that, you know, we're seeing that the idea that government is always your enemy and bad,
yeah,
being disproven here and there, and we, you know, have a Democratic administration that has, in its three most important antitrust jobs, put in like seriously aggressive superstars of antitrust and shoveling trillions of dollars out to, you know, ordinary people to make them think, hey, government's not so bad. So I know I see glimmers and movements of hopefulness all the way around. I don't know if I see it yet on the cultural side, but you know, I'm hopeful. I am not committed in some old fogey way to like it'll never be new again like it was in the 60s. I am so not committed to that. I am eager to be confounded and amazed and awestruck by the radically new getting super traction in our culture.
So when the new artists show up on your lawn, you will not tell them to get up.
No, I'll invite them in. I'll invite them in and give them my special new drugs I've been you know concocting in my attic. You know.
So, all right, I have questions, but I'm skipping ahead because you mentioned it. When I finished reading the book, I wanted to get the words antitrust, like, tattooed on my chest, right? Because that's another big theme of the book is falling away from the idea that, as I've always thought, you know, when corporations got really powerful in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, presidents like Grover Cleveland didn't really do much and let it sort of fester. So they got so powerful, the only thing powerful enough to act as ballast to what they were doing is the federal government. And it wasn't really till, you know, Teddy Roosevelt comes in and starts to right the ship. And then when FDR comes, that's the best possible moment of that.
Thank God for the rich patricians. That's all we got to say. You know?
FDR's, I love that. So, but now, you know, we're seeing the same thing. We have these astonishing monopolies on information, basically. The entire tech sector is crazy. Like, there is no reality in which Facebook and Instagram should be owned by the same company. There's no reality in which Google and YouTube should be owned by the same company, and so on. And yet, I think because, you know, it's complicated, and big tech knows this, and they're going, you know, Facebook, Zuckerberg, they're trying to make it so that Facebook and Instagram are, via the code, so integrated that they cannot be easily separated, because they know this, they think this is coming. And I worry about the politicians not being able to wrap their heads around this. That's another thing I worry about. Like,
well, you think people in Congress may not fully understand how these internet algorithms work? I don't know why you think that, Greg. Yes, of course, they're idiots. And you know, I mean, when and no, and we do need,
they're old.
Well, that too. Yeah. But dude, I mean, we old people don't have to be idiots. No, I have been reading a lot and thinking a lot for various other projects I'm doing about the problems with internet information monopolies. I wrote, you know, as you know, I write about it some in Evil Geniuses, but we have obviously this giant 130-year-old apparatus of antitrust in place to use, but we also do need, and I'm not saying this in some kind of neoliberal, be easy on the, you know, big Google. So, because we don't want to destroy innovation. I'm not saying that at all. We just need some new, there are new things here that we don't quite have the right enforcement tools, in my view, to fix. You know, so somebody has to be smart enough, whether it's members of Congress or the technocrats and aides behind them, to figure out ways to deal with this. Now, using the, even if they're crude and they're not the right hammer to pound this nail, we should fucking pound the nail with what we got if necessary. And another bit of hopefulness, I mean, you know, this is a kind of bipartisan, in all kinds of bad faith, maybe unreal ways from the right, but a semi-bipartisan sentiment about big tech is too big, we got to break them up, we got to do things, you know, and I'm willing to hold my nose and let Josh Hawley come aboard the antitrust train, I got to say.
Yeah, well, we need the vote. Strange bedfellows. Strange bedfellows, indeed. I think, well, there's no ethics there. It's funny, I was, the next episode of this Prevail podcast could be with Brett Petticord, who is a tech guy and knows about all this stuff. And we will talk about, for you listening, how there just is no ethical oversight at all at these companies. They just do whatever the fuck they want. There's no reason for them not to do that. They're relying on their own internal sense of what's right and wrong. And many of them are, you know, kind of libertarian, whatever, of the type of person that you write about eloquently in Evil Geniuses, which does not offer much, you know, in the way of hope. So, you know, it is incumbent upon us, I think, to put rules on them. And maybe they want the rules. Maybe Zuckerberg is tired of being paddled every time he has to go to Washington.
Well, and the history of regulation Teddy Roosevelt, then out of, as you say, out of FDR and the New Deal, is that once there is certain, more or less certainty and clear guardrails and rules and everything, CEOs are happy with that. I mean, yeah. If everybody has to follow these same rules, and none of us can be monopolies, Mark Zuckerberg's wealth is not going to be materially affected by whatever rules come down. Now, that said, you're exactly right. They are for a company like Google, whose initial mission statement was don't be evil. And by the way, I came across in this other research I'm doing, this letter that people should look at. I was amazed by it, or not a letter, a paper that Page and Brin, the founders of Google, wrote in 1998, just as they were launching Google, saying this cannot, you know, search cannot be an ad-based business model. It can't be. That will ruin everything. Well, you know, you're right. And look what you did. And I hadn't realized fully until I started really reading into this the last year is the degree to which an ad-based business model plus the entirely new version of micro-targeting that digital technology can do is the root of most, if not all, but most evil that was in social media. When people say, oh, social media is terrible, it's because they want you, by any means necessary, like an addict, to watch YouTube and diddle around on Facebook as much as possible. Whereas Netflix, or Apple, they don't care how much time you spend as long as you buy their shit or pay their subscription fee. So I hadn't fully realized. So if I were going to write another chapter in Evil Geniuses, it would really be about, now that I understand better the ways in which the money-crazed zillionaires in charge of big tech are basing their, the ones who are really evil there are the ones who are basing their businesses on, addiction is the word.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it. And it's, in a sense, it's hard to blame them. Like, why, you know, they're not set up to do that. They're tech guys. They're trying to make money. They're trying to make the search as best as it could do and all this stuff. That's why it's also, it requires somebody externally to teach them about this stuff.
Yes, like, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. It does. Totally. And whether they'll welcome it or not, I think in the end, we and they more generally, if not Mark Zuckerberg in particular, will welcome, the end of the Wild West era, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that was, okay, phase one, fine, innovation, blah, blah, blah. But now we're in phase two. And by the way, as I mentioned, as I talk about in Evil Geniuses, you would have no Google, you would have no Facebook, if not for US versus Microsoft, the last great antitrust action of the federal government in 1998, right? Because of that, these little piddling startups were allowed to flourish, then become monopolies and want to stay monopolies.
Yeah. You say the Wild West. It's not the Wild West. Zuckerberg and you know the Google guys, they've gone to the hills where the gold are, and now they own all the hills. And there's no more gold, and that's
totally.
It's okay for us to, fix the prices somewhat or whatever.
And that's the other thing. And when I talk about the paradigm being shifted, I mean the idea that the monopolists can really just freely talk about monopoly effectively being good and being the way they are, and that's and have other people in that world, in the business world in general, but specifically in tech, seek to become part of an oligopoly or a monopoly. I mean, that would be amazing 25 years ago to have be the way it is now. So we gotta bust those trusts.
Yeah, no, bust it up. They all want to be assimilated into the Borg, which should not be the kind of the goal. One of the things that you talk about in the book is about Wall Street and the shift towards basically extreme short-term thinking, where the stock price going up is the only thing that matters. Everything else has to be sacrificed to that, including long-range planning, doing things that are good for the business in a five-year window rather than a quarterly window. And that also drives a lot of this stuff in big tech as well, I would imagine. They want the stock prices to go up. They have to keep innovating. They have to keep, selling the data or whatever it is they do. I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about that idea of this what do you want to call it? This distillation of everything that business is supposed to do in a capitalist system to this one sort of arbitrary metric in a lot of ways, and thinking about how it applies to media right now, because the media has also gone, as this has happened, as And part of it is also Reagan's fault because of the fairness doctrine and this and that. Part of it is cable news and the internet being unregulated, whatever. I think the quality generally of journalism has gone down a lot since 1980, say, to pick out an arbitrary year. And I wonder if there's an analogy between stock, between companies focusing only on stock price and journalistic outfits, media companies focusing only on ratings and clicks and in podcast land downloads.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's not just an analogy. I think there's an actual connection. And I'm old enough to remember when I was a kid starting out in media in the 1980s, that even at the time being aware that this change happened where news organizations suddenly between 1980 and 1990, it changed. It was no longer like, oh, we can make a little less margins because we're doing this socially good thing. We are the fourth estate. We're doing this stuff. So we don't have to have 15% margins. We can get away with 9% margins or whatever. I'm making the numbers up. But that changed. And this kind of hyper-capitalism thing that my evil geniuses imposed took over in media, which led to exactly what you're saying, where you know, ratings and earnings by any means necessary is all that mattered. As I say in the book, you know, of course, if you have a business, you want to make money. You don't want to lose money because you can't afford to and you'll go out of business. I get that. We all get that. But what changed was that's all that matters. And then what changed on top of that is, as you say, this share price thing, which isn't even directly a function of profit. Right. It's a function of whatever the mob can be convinced of. Right. I mean, clickbait was a thing happening before that was even a phrase, before there was an internet. Right. In the 80s, you know. So absolutely. It's not analogous. It is analogous and actually the thing that was happening. And that's why it's these talking about these wonky things like, well, would it be different? How would a subscription model be different than an ad-based model? It would be hugely different. And that's why we have to talk about these wonky things because, you know, again, I guess I can overdo the idea that it's addictive, but that's the thing. You know, we all like, you know, maybe a cup of coffee, a drink, whatever, hit a weed, whatever it is. But you don't want to do it like 20 cups of coffee a day and be stoned all the time. And that's what hyper-capitalism, especially in the internet realm, wants us to do.
No, I think it's true. And it affects everything. It affects how people consume. And it also affects how it's produced. But In 2012, I started an arts and culture site, which, you know, was not much read, but whenever we had really a lot of hits, it was because we did this gimmick where it was 50 names. We'd have the 50 best pro football names and the 50 best band names. So I found myself walking around only thinking in those terms, like, what would be a good top 50 list?
Totally.
And eventually you're like, this is fucking stupid. Who cares?
Totally, you know? Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, I co-started a thing called Inside.com that was covering the entertainment media business in 1999, 2000. And again, it wasn't even about clickbait, but to the same point, it was like, wow, we could do this thing where everybody votes on who's the most powerful person in Hollywood. That would be awesome. And it would change. And in that sense, I subsequently realized that what the technology can do is not necessarily played out years ahead what it should do. It's right. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's nuclear power. It's like any technology is not bad in and of itself, and it's fun and it's amazing, but like, be careful, you know, and let the grown-ups come in and tell you how you can and can't use it, you know.
Well, that's another point though, is this idea that the technology itself is inherently bad. Like, I remember there used to be these bumper stickers on cars around here that said like, kill your television. And it's like, that's like saying burn the library. You know, there's no difference. The television itself isn't what's bad. It's the shit that's on it, you know, and it's Taliban-ish to think in those terms. So I want to, I know you know, I don't want to keep you too long. So I have two more questions for you. Okay. In Evil Geniuses, we can't, you talked about it before, somebody mentioning the Koch brothers. And one of the things that's really interesting is that it's not really just the Koch brothers. It's a bunch of different super rich libertarian guys, mostly guys.
Mostly guys.
Rebecca Mercy. So, but right. that's the only way. And, but the Koch brothers are almost like the front. They're the ones that are out in front and almost operate as a shield, even though they don't have as much money as some of these other people. Like the Bradleys is a family I'd never heard of before. And then right as I was reading that chapter, I came across on Senator Whitehouse's page, there's this whole thing that dives into who these foundations and Leonard Leo and all this. I wrote a big thing about Leonard Leo and Kavanaugh, so I'm interested in that. But I want you to just talk a little bit about some of these other who are these Bradley people? Because
Like most of these billionaires, most of whom are not as well known as the Kochs. And by the way, the Kochs were not well known at all for the first 20 years they were doing their thing. And by the way, one of the Kochs is dead, so there's that. Yes, David is no longer with us. But the Bradleys are this, you know, rich Midwesterners who are these true believers, you know, billionaire libertarian true believers. I mean, of course, libertarianism. I mean, economic libertarians. If you are white and rich and in many cases young, a lot easier to be a libertarian. Like, hey, look, well, what's wrong? What's wrong with doing it by yourself, right? Yeah. So, but the Bradleys, along with the Olins and the Scaifes and the rest, who were the part of the original generation, along with Charles and David Koch, of these billionaire evil geniuses, the Bradleys came along later. And yes, as you're suggesting, are you know, they're not at the scale of the Kochs yet, but they are very, very important in doing the bad stuff that this confederacy of non-dunces have been doing and are doing. Speaking of how they, you know, evil geniuses pop into the news, the great Jane Mayer had a great piece in The New Yorker recently about the who is behind funding-wise and pushing all of the various voter suppression, election subversion bills in state legislatures. It's all of these guys. It is the evil geniuses and the Bradley Foundation, which made me take a kind of gasp for breath practically. Because even though, you know, I mean, because these people are not nuts. They are greedy and evil, but they are not nuts. And so part of me still thinks, well, you should know better. You're actually ruining democracy. You're actually ruining this country for good. And there they are, you know, going for the last, the very bridge too far, trying to wreck the actual democratic system.
Yeah. And aligning themselves in the process with Putin's Russia, which, you know, say what you will about the John Birch Society. At least they know that Russia was bad, right? That's my stock joke.
Yeah. They knew that communist Russia was bad.
Well, yeah. That's another great point, by the way, you make in the book, is how similar what they're doing is to the failed communist state. Which is another good point. It's like they rail against this state and then try to make it become the state. Sort of in a similar way to how, you know, no one wants Sharia law here in the United States, whereas actually, you know, the only difference between what the hard right conservative people want and what the Taliban wants is that the right is they do not want their women to be masked under any circumstances. Right. That's the key difference.
Not now, but that could change in a heartbeat because they have no consistent ideology since 2016. Right. I mean, if suddenly like masking was good. Masking's good. I mean, and that's the scary and amazing thing about the Republican Party and the right these days is that the lack of, I mean, consistency in their pernicious ideologies.
It's weird. What do you make of Liz Cheney? Because I really think that, you know, she's doing the right thing right now and she might have her cynical reasons for doing it, but I think it's pretty brave what she's doing. And it's also setting her, like, she's either going to be the nominee for president the next time around, or she's going to be in the gulag. I mean, I don't know what the...
No, I'm with you. And I am, you know, obviously we can't forget our differences with the Liz Cheneys of the world and the solidly, bravely anti-Trumpist right. But they are the remaining real conservatives. And, you know, just like, you know, the United States fought with the Soviet Union to defeat the greater evil of Hitler and fascism.
Boom.
You know, I'm with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Perfect. Perfect. That's the same exact analogy that I like to use. And it's a glitched simulation world when I find myself getting excited about stuff Liz Cheney is tweeting. Makes me, I need to take a shower or something.
Yeah. Well, Bill Kristol was my first, like, why am I, I'm following, I'm liking, I'm even retweeting Bill Kristol, I was thinking 4 years ago, but there you go.
He's been pretty solid. He's off the deep end on the Afghanistan stuff, but he's been pretty solid.
Sure, no. Once you, I mean, the neocons now can let that freak flag fly again, you know?
But. Yeah, they're doing the thing. So, okay. So speaking of which, this is the last question. So in a few weeks, it's going to be the 20th anniversary of 9/11. I was there. I lived in Manhattan or in New York rather for 10 years. And I was in Midtown when the towers fell. You're from Nebraska, but you've lived in New York for a long, long time. What are your thoughts coming into the anniversary? Anything that you want to share?
Everybody should read Jen Senior's cover story in The Atlantic about a family whose son was killed on 9/11. It's a great story. And I didn't know I could read a story about, you know, Americans, the actual event that would teach me new things and make me feel new things. Anyway, that, it's interesting. I mean, everybody said 9/11 changed everything, and sure, it changed a lot of things, and it made us pursue two disastrous wars and all that. But if you look today at what's existentially terrible about America, whether it's economic insecurity or ongoing racial reckonings or climate or whatever, none of it has very much to do with 9/11, right? I mean, we thought that was the big historical pivot moment, and it was in its way and all that, but like, it's like, oh, there was that thing that happened and you know, and of course, with the Taliban taking over Afghanistan, it's like so on the nose if you're writing a fictional version of things that on September 11th, there they are in Afghanistan. And like, oh, it's just Sisyphean loop. But in terms of like ongoing geopolitical or even American, how we are, where history is going, I don't know. This great clash of East and West cultures that was some kind of spectacular epitome of, not so much.
Yeah. Well said. Sorry, I sprung the question on you. And then I realized I shouldn't end the interview on a down note.
Right.
That was also a mistake. I'm new at this.
Down note. I mean, it's I mean, you know, there's lots of different down notes you could end it on. And I'll tell you the thing that I sometimes think of when we're talking, you know, and I have thought during the last year and a half, when we're now like inured to 600,000 Americans being killed, maybe half of them unnecessarily by this pandemic. I think of those numbers and how it inures us to ghastly large numbers of deaths. And then I think back to this several thousand who were killed on 9/11 or the 2,500 U.S. service people who've been killed in Afghanistan. And alas, it makes me think, it distorts one's sense of horror about death, given these numbers that we're dealing with. So that's let's end it there on an up note.
Death is always, I guess death is the final, you know, the final way to end it. The numbers are interesting, and I think it all goes back and cycles back to what you've been writing about, you know, to the fantasy land thing, because when you hear numbers like that, 600,000, whatever the real number is, not to mention the people that have long COVID and who are going to suffer from this for, you know, long, long periods of time, we still don't know. And now we're heading back into school. It's probably going to get worse, especially in the South. But it's hard, I think, for people's brains to wrap their minds around all the stuff that's happened. There's so much stuff has happened, even in the last year, between the insurrection and the pandemic. It's really just this, you know, geyser of bad news. And we're now so used to having to parse out what's true and what's not true, and we're being told things from so many different angles, I think it hurts your brain to even try to contemplate, you know, numbers like that. And I think that's why people are more muted about it than maybe they should be.
It does. And again, before I go, one semi-hopeful version of numbers, you know, at this point, it is only 20-odd% of Americans, less than 20 probably, who have chosen not to be vaccinated. That's a terrible number, and it's a lot of people, but like, it's a small minority. Similarly, it's as I do my census of various kinds of falsehood believing crazies in Fantasyland, you know, it's a quarter of America is always nuts.
Yeah.
You know, so and by the way, it's really only a quarter of America who are the hardcore true believing Republicans. So you know, I mean, as we've seen in other countries where minorities can exercise political control and do horrible things, that's a number to reckon with. But if three quarters of us are relatively sane and relatively decent, you know, could be worse.
It could be worse.
That's my new motto. That is my motto for the last few years. Definitely.
I feel like we're in good hands now with Biden, too. I have to say that I really think that he's, I didn't know what, I thought he would be good, but he's been much, much better than, not that he hasn't made mistakes, certainly, that I've discussed, but he's been much, much better than I even could have hoped for. He's nostalgic for FDR, it seems like, in a way that is only good for most of us in this country. So, you know.
Totally.
That's a great, hopeful thing too. Kurt Anderson, this has been such a thrill for me. Thank you so much for coming.
It was great. It was a great, great pleasure. I completely enjoyed it. Glad we did it. Thank you.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.